Green Sense Radio is brought to you by Green Sense Farms. We're changing the world with sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live, so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
Welcome to Green Sense, a weekly look at the people, policies, and innovations that are changing our world. Here's Robert
Colangelo.
Thank
you for joining us this week on Green Sense. Glad you chose to listen to us, and we're going to entertain you and inform you on good, sustainable decisions. Bob, what issues will we cover this week?
Robert, something that's still going on this weekend is the strike of General Motors, and there is a connection to electric vehicles there. Some other green automotive news we'll get into with Tom Appel, our good friend from Consumer Guide Automotive. While we're on the transportation beat, how are we doing in the U.S. when it comes to public transportation? A whole big exhaustive report just came out from Wallet Hub, so we'll take a deep dive into that one.
All coming up on this edition of Green Sense. It's green automotive news time, and the man we rely on for it is Tom Appel, publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive. Tom, welcome back to Green Sense.
Thanks for having me.
Well, today we have two topics. One is the U.S. mail truck proposal to use electric delivery vehicles and the GM strike. Two very different ones, or maybe they're connected. How would you like to start off?
Well, you're right, Robert. They are actually connected, and it's interesting how connected they are. The General Motors strike is raging on. There's a lot of people waiting to get back to work. And one of the key points, one of the talking points of this strike is what's going to happen to one of General Motors' factories, and that's the Lordstown Assembly Plant in Ohio. And the question mark there is that General Motors would like to sell it or shutter it, and the UAW would like General Motors to do something with it. But General Motors has a buyer, sort of, and this is a company called Workhorse. And Workhorse is working to get a contract from the United States Postal Service to build, and this is a big number of electric vehicles, 160,000 electric delivery vehicles to replace the old ones that we all know and see all the time. And those were called the Grumman Long Life Vehicles, or LLV. So there's this big contract hanging out there. And if Workhorse can secure this contract, not only will they keep a General Motors plant running, but they're going to replace about 160,000 vehicles that are currently very old and very dirty with electric vehicles.
Well, that sounds fantastic. Is the UAW behind that sale?
They're actually not behind that sale. General Motors wants clearance to do that, and the UAW would like General Motors to put something more viable in there. One of the interesting points about this is that 160,000 vehicles sounds like a lot, but it is below the annual capacity of that factory. Additionally, the contract that Workhorse would secure would be to supply that many vehicles over 4 or 5 years. So Workhorse would have to build more vehicles than that to make that factory viable.
And GM is under no obligation to put that plant back to productive use. So I would think a common conclusion would be to shutter it if they don't have another buyer.
Yeah, at this point, a couple of key points. You're right. General Motors is probably in a better place if they can just unload it or shut it down. And secondly, Workhorse does not have this contract yet. And the post office has put off a decision. I think that they're weighing heavily the costs of going electric. They put off this decision for another 6 months.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
Tom, anytime you change a product line in an assembly manufacturing operation, it requires significant amount of capital to do that. To go from making automobiles to electric trucks sounds like a heavy investment in the production and changing and retooling of the line. Thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Just the handling of the battery is such a different thing than dropping in a powertrain with a gasoline engine and a transmission. So it is very different, and Workhorse would have to come up with capital to update and modify the factory. So how viable this actual Workhorse plan is there's a lot of skeptics out there.
Well, and I would think if I was the post office, would you give a company that doesn't even have a factory a contract to build that many vehicles?
That is the first big question. And Workhorse seems like a fairly viable company, but no, you might not. And secondly, the post office is now obliged to install charging facilities, which may or may not have been involved in the cost of the other vehicles they're considering. So this is not only a paradigm change, but there is additional cost on top of the per unit cost.
Well, good ideas have followers, and it sounds like Amazon is on the same track. They're looking to purchase 100,000 electric delivery vehicles. What do you have on that, Tom?
Yeah, they are. And this is one of those big changes that I think will help with proof of concept. We've got the Tesla out there that has sold several hundred thousand vehicles to the general public, and I think that helped change minds. And now Amazon.com is considering electric delivery vehicles, which will also help, I think, people change minds. And Amazon, of course, is a very large, respected company, and that kind of adoption, I think, really furthers the cause.
What about UPS, FedEx? You know, they've got plenty of delivery vehicles. Have they looked at going electric?
They have electrified. There's some very interesting aftermarket modifiers that will install semi-hybrid systems on these vehicles to make them greener. I don't know how many of them committed to anything pure electric, but they have done some mild hybrid stuff.
Tom, I'd like to bring up two other things. One is the Corvette. I know that that's not such a green car in most people's eyes, but it is a beautifully redesigned car and an American icon. And the new Corvette with the mid-engine, the short front, and the Italian styling at around $60,000 is quite a bargain. What are your thoughts and insights on that?
Yeah, it is. It is quite a bargain. It's actually something of a miracle. And I think that most of the media had expected that the move to mid-engine from front engine was going to drive the cost up to close to $100,000. And I think the fact that this car comes in around 60 embarrasses a lot of supercar manufacturers. So that's kind of exciting. There's all sorts of America rah-rah going on here, and it's hard not to love the Corvette. Additionally, what's exciting is that Corvettes have traditionally been actually high fuel economy vehicles. Contrary, I think, to all expectation, the large pushrod V8 and usually a high top gear have meant that the Corvette's actually always been very fuel efficient on the highway, getting close to 30 mpg, which is kind of a fun fact, too.
GM's making America green again with the Corvette? Is that what you're telling me?
I don't know how much of this is intentional. It's just there's something slightly, I don't know, defiantly American about a big pushrod V8 and the fact that it's just so relaxed on the highway. And you compare that to the engines you find in Ferraris or Lamborghinis that are smaller and much more high strung, and their fuel economy is just dreadful. But they make a different sound and they do a different thing. But the Corvette is very specifically Corvette and a very American institution. And the big old V8, which is a delightful thing to drive.
I never thought I'd be talking about high mile per gallon in a Corvette. So that's a great insight that you share with us. Well, I wanted to pick your brain on another issue. Our producer and good friend, Bob Kessler, recently bought a car, and he's an urban dweller. And he was looking to buy an electric car, but one of his challenges is there's no chargers on the street. So I thought we'd have Bob in to talk a little bit about his challenges with being a electric car owner in an urban area. Bob?
First of all, I do want to send out a shout out to our buddy Tom. He helped me in choosing the vehicle that I got, which I ended up getting a Ford Fiesta ST, right? So it's a Fiesta, but it's got some interesting features under the hood and all around with the suspension. So thanks, Tom. He helped me out a lot. But yeah, when I was looking for the car, I did want to get something with good gas mileage, which this one does have. But an electric car, for me, I live in Logan Square near northwest side of Chicago. There is absolutely no place for me to charge it unless I want to go to Walgreens for 3 hours and shop, which I don't, by the way. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know, Tom, if you've heard of anything, if there's any initiatives in cities or other places to add chargers to residential areas. You know, people without a garage like me, we don't have a lot of options.
No, it's funny you should bring up this topic today, too, Bob, because I was just speaking to the folks at Nissan about the Leaf and the Leaf Plus, which are pure electric vehicles. And it was just this topic we were talking about. And at this point, they don't actually have a ready solution for how urban dwellers might go electric, because really the sort of green car template involves charging at home. You need to install a level 2 charger at home, and then you're probably good. And if you can find one on long trips that's far away, that's going to help you out. But they don't seem to have a viable plan yet for folks who can't charge at home. And one of the things, I recently got an EVgo card, which is a charging station network. And when I was recently driving the Nissan Leaf, I charged once at a level 3 station nearby, and it was very quick and very efficient. It was also somewhat expensive, more expensive actually than if I was driving a gas vehicle. So that's not viable either. It's a good solution. It's a good emergency situation, but it's not a long-term plan.
So Bob seems to have hit on a nerve here. Electric cars are great for urban settings, but if you can't have access to a charger, what are you going to do? Any thoughts, Tom, on possible solutions?
There is one long-term EV viability plan that involves installing electric outlets in light poles, which is really interesting because you already have the power being run to them, which might reduce the actual infrastructure cost. But even then, you run into a situation of how that's paid for and what kind of infrastructure administration is involved in that. But that's one of the plans to try to get charging onto the street, because right now I think stations are not generally close enough to houses to make those work.
And if you put these in parking garages, the fees you'd have to pay to park overnight and charge your car would probably be exorbitant and just not cost effective. So this is a real challenge out there.
Yeah, I think this is actually the next big challenge. And it, also, I think that just demographically, urban dwellers are exactly the people that are more likely to be early electric car adopters. So this is a barrier that needs to be addressed.
Well, Tom, thank you for sharing your thoughts. And let's dive into this in future shows and see if we can come up with some solutions.
I would love that.
That's Tom Appel, publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive, on the latest green automotive news. Read his articles, car reviews, and more at consumerguide.com. I'm Robert Colangelo, and I remind you to subscribe to the GS podcast at greensensefarms.com.
GreenSense Radio is brought to you by GreenSense Farms. We're changing the world with our sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live, so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
Americans take 10 billion trips a year on public transportation. What should also get your attention is that for every dollar invested in public transportation, it generates $4 in economic returns, according to the American Public Transportation Association. WalletHub recently released results on its new survey on 2019 cities with the best and worst public transportation, and we're joined again by WalletHub analyst Jill Gonzalez. Jill, welcome back to Green Sense.
Thanks for having me back.
That figure I just quoted from the American Public Transportation Association, that for every dollar invested in public transportation, $4 are generated in economic return. Tell us a little bit about those economic returns, you know, what they look like and, you know, how they benefit the public.
Well, I mean, obviously, this is something much like education, much like a lot of other government provided services. When you invest in it, it really ends up being an investment for your local community. And that's really what transportation is, public transportation. It has drastically lower odds of an accident than driving a personal vehicle, helps to cut down pollution from emissions. So that's where we see this investment really put back in to our localities.
Number one on the overall rankings is Seattle. What makes Seattle rank so high?
Seattle does really well when it comes to things like its public transit resources and its safety and reliability. So obviously very important things when we're talking about public transportation. Just when it comes to safety and reliability, we don't see that many public transit safety and security events. That includes things like collision, derailment, fire, security. We don't see a lot of that going on in Seattle. So obviously that is good news. Not a lot of injuries or fatalities per passenger miles traveled either.
Have you ridden the Seattle public transportation and do you know anything about it firsthand?
No. So this is a study, not a survey. So it's not going to be people's opinions on this. It's all existing data from places like the Center for Neighborhood Technology, Xfastison, American Public Transportation Association, and the FTA.
Well, one city that's internationally known for its public transportation system is New York, with the subways, passenger rail, and even the Staten Island Ferry. What's New York doing right?
At least when it comes to accessibility, is doing everything right. A lot of options in terms of public transportation, pretty much always running. So that's also good news. And a big share of commuters who use and rely on public transit, which was another metric that we used here. So access and convenience is definitely there for New York. The reason why it's not in the top five is because it comes down to safety and reliability, especially in the last couple of years. I think New Yorkers will tell you a lot of that reliability has gone downhill. So that's the one area that it could use improvement in.
Does cost factor into the ranking?
Yes, it does. So as far as accessibility, we do look at cost of tickets and if there's any type of reimbursement system for like late trains or something like that.
Now we go to Chicago, which is famous for the L train or the elevated train, and that covers most of the city, and that's not far from where GreenSense is based. And it ranks in the middle of the list at 22. What does Chicago need to do to improve and get higher up on the ranking?
Well, still definitely above average. We did look at 100 cities here, so 22 is not that bad. But again, it does the same thing that New York is doing well in terms of access. But when it comes to reliability and when it comes to safety, that's where it could be doing a lot better.
The survey also looked at longest average car commute time, and the top five are all large cities. The number one is Chicago, meaning it's got very bad traffic and it takes a long time to get to your destination during those periods, followed by Washington, D.C., San Francisco, Boston, and New York. And that makes common sense. These are very high populated cities and they have a lot of traffic congestion. Are any of these cities that are ranked high on this list doing anything new, interesting, or innovative with public transportation to combat traffic congestion?
Well, I think a city like San Francisco is really doing cool things just in terms of, you know, taking people from the city to big technology hubs like Google, like Apple, via shuttle. And that's usually done by the organizations themselves, but obviously does cut down on commute times. It does cut down on using your personal vehicle. It's better for the environment. So shuttles like that are something that I think are unique to San Francisco.
Mobility is changing greatly. There's so many ways to get around these days, from electric scooters to mopeds to electric cars. And some of these are really fun. You know, when people think of public transportation, they don't get too excited by it. Are there any exciting new cool technologies that are coming out that make people want to ride public transportation?
Yeah, I think you said it best. Scooters, electric bikes are now more of a thing. I live in DC myself, and I've seen mopeds that are now rentable. So there are definitely a lot of forms of new public transportation systems that are coming out that I think still have a long way to go in terms of reliability and safety. But I think it's a good thing that they're being introduced to bigger cities.
Madison, Wisconsin, one of my favorite cities, ranked number 5, which is pretty high on the list. But its main mode of public transportation currently are buses. You know, I found that buses sometimes have some stigma when it comes to public transportation, and they have disadvantages compared to other modes of transportation like light or heavy rail. What is Madison doing with its bus system that makes it so outstanding?
Well, right now, Madison has one of the safest bus systems in the country. No fatalities over the past year, no injuries. So that's one thing, I think, obviously being a college town, that certainly helped it rise to number 5.
What are the factors that are keeping cities from spending more on public transportation?
Well, it's one piece of the puzzle, and a lot of times it just is not prioritized. Hopefully cities are investing in things like education or green space instead. That's not always the case. There's certainly other things that need to be addressed, but especially cities with an older public transportation system, I think there's this sense of, hey, it's there, you can use it. Does it need to be improved? Yes, but is it something that we're getting to right now?
In these older cities that have had public transportation for a long time, they've become degraded, and it's very expensive to fix them, especially in New York. So how are some of these big cities with older transportation systems that need repair and investment, how are they handling that?
Well, Seattle, Boston, both of these cities are going through renovations when it comes to their public transportation system. They're expanding it, which is also helpful. Same can be said for Washington, D.C. So although the expansion is usually slow, it is good and it is rewarded within the metrics, at least on our side, that expansion is happening or that renovations are happening in general.
Did you see any geographic bias in the country and how public transportation is viewed? For example, the West seems like a much more car-centric versus the East, which public transportation has been around for a long time and just seems standard.
Well, I think it really comes down to what the city itself is doing. I mean, you have places like Reno, Nevada, Honolulu, Portland, all in the top 10, San Francisco up there as well. So I don't necessarily think it's geometric bias. I do think it's really what the city itself is doing. So San Francisco is obviously a much different story than, say, Los Angeles.
Well, Jill, thank you for sharing your thoughts and the highlights of the report, and we appreciate you being on Green Sense.
Anytime.
That's Jill Gonzalez, analyst with Wallet Hub, on their new survey of the cities with the best and worst public transportation systems. This is Robert Colangelo. Subscribe to our podcast at greensensefarms.com.
Green Sense Radio is brought to you by Green Sense Farms. We're changing the world with our sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live, so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
We hope you enjoyed this edition of Green Sense. Visit greensensefarms.com to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, and you can check out the list of radio stations that air our show. All you have to do is stay fresh, keep innovating, because when you're green, you grow.
Green Sense Radio is brought to you by Green Sense Farms. We're changing the world with sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
Green Sense is recorded in the Duneland ecosystem on the eastern shores of Lake Michigan. The program is copyright Green Sense Farms, all rights reserved.